and this is, I think it's just a good general rule of thumb in anything you're doing, but especially farming, until you go out and do it for a while and like fail a couple times.
Yeah.
That's when you learn.
Okay.
Anybody listening to this that wants to get into oyster farming, call me first. I got a lot that I've done wrong that I would love to tell you about first.
And we can put your phone number on here if you
there
want.
There you go. Yeah, please. All my contact info, my Facebook, my social security number, whatever they need.
Hey guys, just a quick insert here. The way Brie and I record these is we're remote, so she has her audio file and I have mine. For this introduction, I lost mine. So what I'm going to do is play hers and just react to it as if we're having the conversation in real time, when in reality I'm talking to an audio file. So yeah, here we go. Hello everyone, and welcome to No Planet B, a podcast where we're talking about climate change and its effects on Planet A. I'm Wyatt.
And I'm Brianna. This week, we talked to a couple of guys, Matt and Dylan. They're incredible. Mm-hmm. Told us a lot about oyster farming and how it can be sustainable, which I personally had no idea about.
Yeah, I also had no idea about that.
Big same.
Yeah, big same. Uh-oh.
Matt and Dylan, yeah.
Yeah, Matt and Dylan. Yeah, so these guys are total rock stars over at Estuary Oysters, and we're really happy that they...
Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh, I have no idea how to explain that context. over at Estuary Oysters, we're really glad they were able to sit down with us. It was I know I say this every time, but this interview was the most fun, and we hope you enjoy it. So here we go. So this is going to be a pretty loaded question, but what exactly do y'all do?
So we farm oysters is the two word explanation of that. But basically, the Florida Department of Agriculture back in the 90s approved these lease sites in the Gulf for the purpose of farming oysters and clams. Then in 2014, you could utilize the entire water column to do so. So what that means is before that time, any kind of shellfish cultivation you were doing had to be in the bottom 6 inches of the water column. The quality of an oyster that's grown in the mud is about as bad as you would think, just okay. From a common sense perspective. And that's what a lot of, honestly, my knowledge comes from, is just experiential common sense. I don't really have much of a scientific background.
Okay.
But the idea of being able to utilize the entire water column to grow oysters specifically is that the majority of algae growth happens in the top 18 inches of the water column, which is that's what we specifically do. So we've got a system that allows our oysters to be grown in cages, which float within that top 18 inches of the water column. So they never touch the bottom. Therefore there's no sand in them. There's no grit in them. They're literally just sort of sat at this space of algae buffet, mm-hmm. where all they do is eat all the time.
Yeah.
They never come out of the water. There are some farmers who use certain techniques where they'll bring them out of the water to try to sort of replicate that idea of them naturally coming in and out with the tides.
Okay, cool.
We don't do that because we want to grow them as quickly as possible. And between Matt and I, we actually don't think that really is of benefit in the way that some people do.
Mm.
And that's another thing too, is this, because this is such a new thing specifically to the state of Florida, being able to grow them in the entire water column, there's still a lot of unknowns. So there's still a lot of figuring out what it is that we're specifically doing, a lot of screwing up.
Yeah.
If you were to ask me specific strategies for how to best farm oysters, I could at least tell you all the things not to do.
Okay.
But we're,
I can respect that.
We're getting there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Does harvesting them at that depth, does that affect, like, because usually they're benthic, right? They're kind of like at the bottom.
Is that what benthic
oysters?
Means?
Yeah, I think
that's going to show you my level of scientific knowledge right there. Well,
how does that affect them with their interaction with sunlight, you know?
That's a great question. What we have noticed specifically is that whenever we have any kind of die-off, which we're getting to that point as we're recording right now, it's what, July 3rd? We're getting into those hot parts of the year. And that's specifically when we start to see the biggest percentages of die-off. And what we've noticed is the oysters that die seem to be those closest to the surface. And I think really all that comes down to is heat. The fact that they're almost sitting in like bath water right there at the surface, whereas the oysters beneath them, you know, closer to like the 10 to 18 inch margin, they do a lot better.
Okay. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Which is, you know, in its own sense is another reason it's interesting is because natural oysters do come out of the water twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like when they're in their natural habitat, they're already used to that to begin with.
Yeah. So what exactly is a keystone species and why is the oyster considered one?
A keystone species basically is any species which other organisms in that ecosystem rely on that species' existence. So the oyster specifically, I've read that there are over 3,000 other species that rely on oysters being in the water. Oysters are sort of the filter of the ecosystem, literally and figuratively.
Mm-hmm.
There are famous pictures that you can pull up on the internet of like two tanks, two like aquarium tanks filled with water, one of them having oysters in it, one not, and within 30 minutes, the one with oysters in it is crystal clear.
Okay.
So a fully mature oyster is said to be able to filter 50 gallons of water a day.
Jesus.
The farm that we manage at its peak, actually, so far, the most we've ever had in the water is 2 million. So, I mean, we're talking about billions of gallons of water being filtered just by way of us, you know, starting and growing a profitable company,
mm-hmm.
you know, as sort of a very positive externality of that.
Yeah.
But in doing so, when we were first told that we would be allowed to do this, it had to be done in a space in which there was no seagrass growing on the seafloor because they didn't really know what the effects were going to be scientifically. So they said, "We'll let you do it, but we're going to sort of give you like the poorest quality space to do it in." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we had to make sure that in doing so, if seagrass started to come back, that they wouldn't kick us off, that they wouldn't tell us to move because now it's protected.
Yeah, that's fair.
But we've been doing this since 2014, and already there's seagrass growing back. Directly beneath our our oyster cages, heavily, yeah. And in doing so, you're seeing all those species that live in the grass come back.
Yeah.
So the bigger species that eat them, and then eat them all the way up to. I mean, I think the biggest species that we've been seeing a lot of out there, the black drum, you know, upwards of, you know, 5 feet, 6 feet long.
Yeah.
Just, you know, predator fish. Oh, you're talking basically the entire food chain out there has come back in a matter of a couple of years.
Cool.
It's incredible how fragile the ecosystem is. And I know that sounds kind of cliche, but when you actually like get to live in it and work in it, you know, 5, 6, 7 days a week, you get to see that in short time. That's the other thing is like people talk about changes taking place. And when you think about it, it's usually like, oh, that's 10 years ago or that, you know, that's 10 years away's problem or that's the next generation's problem. But you get to see things happen almost sometimes immediately.
That's kind of the point of this is we want to hear from people who are seeing this like every day.
Sure.
I think it's so cool. I think it's like equally, if not more important than like having an understanding. Yeah. Or
I almost wish that we could have done this actually on the boat, on the lease with like a video camera. There'd be so many cool things so that we could show you. Maybe we'll do like a part two later on with a camera or something.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
You guys say you've been working there since 2014. Do you guys know people who have been working there for longer that have experienced like a lot of changes or...
We're not the first people to harvest oysters in the state of Florida by a long shot. We are some of the first to utilize the specific techniques that we're using, the specific equipment that we use, at least in this area. But we're in Apalachee Bay, which is very close to Apalachicola Bay. And anybody who knows about oysters knows that Apalachicola Bay, at least one time, was the sort of the oyster capital of the world. So with that, there are generations of people who... I think we know somebody who's like a fourth generation oyster tonger. And those are the guys who you go out on the boat with tongs. They look like big metal rakes, basically. And then you would rake up clumps of wild oysters. And the ones that were at least 3 inches large, you would keep those, cull them off, you know, basically knock off the barnacles and baby oyster spat off of those.
Mm.
And then they would bring in, you know, I mean, you're talking thousands of dollars in oysters a day.
Yeah,
That's what the industry was built up of, and there's a lot of theories as to why that no longer exists, why people aren't able to do that anymore, and a lot of that has to do with over-harvesting, practices that were not sustainable. And that's the great thing about oyster farming; it is a very sustainable practice. We're not taking oysters from the water; we're actually making. So that's one of our mottos: we're making, not taking.
Oh, cool.
We are actually putting oysters when they're babies, putting them in the water, growing them to 3 inches, and then taking those back out. So we're not actually taking anything out of the wild at all.
So you guys are like oyster gardening, kind of.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good way of putting it. We're oyster gardeners. I mean, I wouldn't put that on my business card, but sure.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Another heavy hitter. Have you guys noticed any effects from climate change on the oysters?
I'm going to say the answer to that is no. For us specifically, and I was doing some reading on that, a lot of the research that's been done, which we might be able to tap into, a lot of that's been done more in like Louisiana.
Mm.
That's sort of the closest place that's been doing what we do for a while. And for whatever reason, there's just a bigger focus out there. I think through LSU, they do a lot of research. Closer to us would be like Auburn University. Dr. Bill Walton does a lot of research there. But there was a study done by, I want to say LSU, but I'm probably wrong. But that was their main question, is how is climate change affecting oyster farming and oyster tonguing, just the oyster industry in general. And the general consensus of that is it's not affecting us here in the Gulf yet.
Mm.
There are other places that it is affecting them, such as like up in Washington, sort of the Pacific Northwest. There's a study done that showed over the last decade, there was a loss of like $110 million in the oyster industry directly to climate change.
Yeah.
How they came to that conclusion, I have no idea. Those are people way smarter than me. But that is to say, yes, it is. Yeah. That is to say that climate change is having an effect specifically. And we do know, if things don't change, it will affect us here probably sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the big one is, how fast temperatures are rising, and the amount of carbon dioxide that's being put into the atmosphere that is then being absorbed into the oceans, into the Gulf of Mexico specifically for us, it changes the pH of the water. So over the last 100 years or so, basically since the Industrial Revolution, the pH of the water has actually increased by 26% toward the acidity side. And what that does basically for mollusks specifically is it makes it very difficult for them to grow their shells.
Okay.
So they have a very weakened shell. They're much more susceptible to predation and UV radiation. So when that day does come that we see climate change affecting us in that way, it's probably going to be that they're just not able to really survive that long because their shells are weak.
So are you guys like preparing for climate change, or?
We're doing our part to not contribute to it, but I guess that would be a different, different question. The only things that we really talk about day to day, which is funny because we were actually talking about it just this morning, is how can we grow our oysters closer to the bottom of that 18 inches of water column so that we can still take advantage of the fact that we're in a high algae growth space, but we're not right there at the surface. That's going to help. That'll help with the heat problem, but I don't know that that's going to really help us much with the acidity problem. Now, for Matt and I specifically, we're blessed in that our oyster leases are located in Spring Creek, Florida. Spring Creek is surrounded by almost 1 million acres of protected wildlands between Apalachicola National Forest and the St. Mark's Wildlife Refuge.
Mm.
So basically protected wildlands with, you know, no unnatural runoff, so to speak. There are properties around that area that are on sewer systems. So there are sewage leaks into that area, but that's like the highest amount of pollution that that space specifically gets.
Oh, cool.
But the freshwater influx in that area is not fed by a river. It's fed by a spring. So Spring Creek is a collection of 14 different springs. It's one of the largest freshwater springs in the world. I think it's like 1.4 billion gallons of fresh water into the Gulf every day. And our farm is like half a mile from that. Whereas, say, like Apalachicola Bay, the oysters you're getting from there, their freshwater influx is the Apalachicola River, which goes, you know, you're getting the runoff all the way up from like Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know, so there are some challenges that they face that we don't, just by way of what specifically gets into the water where we're at.
Any water that makes it into the ground system there that is slightly acidic, as it moves through those underground cave systems of limestone, it erodes at the limestone and then causes the acidity of the water to drop. So by the time it makes it to us, it's at a suitable level for the shellfish. And plus that makes, as it erodes away at the limestone walls, it creates a calcium-rich water, which oysters utilize to make their shell much faster. That's why our area can grow an oyster shell, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 times the rate at anywhere else. Like, for instance, in Ireland, it can take 13, 14 years to grow an oyster. Up north, it's 3, 4 years, 6 years. And for us, it's like 6 to 9 months.
Wow, that's so cool.
The fastest oyster that we've ever seen grown to 3 inches, and that's sort of the average market size. Cool. We saw in 2015, there was a rancher whose lease is like a stone's throw away from ours, mm-hmm. he grew an oyster in 3-inch oyster in 99 days. Like, I don't use that as like a common figure because I don't want anybody to expect like, wow, 99 days to grow an oyster. But
yeah,
they do grow extremely fast where we're at. And a lot of that just has to do specifically with the geographical, topographical.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, since there is such a high availability of carbon in the water, they lay down their layer of carbon in their CaCO3 layer. It's very, very brittle because they lay it down so fast. So that aragonite layer is much weaker than any other oyster in the world, but it's because they're able to grow it so fast. And when the availability of carbon is there, they draw it in left and right and don't stop.
Mm-hmm.
So in other areas, it's much colder. There's not as much availability of the ions there. So the shells just get really strong. So we'll see that in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
If you grab a oyster out of the bay here in the wintertime and you crack it open and you were to break the shell,
mm-hmm.
it would be much harder to break in that particular growing season, but then when you get to the summertime, that new lip is really, really fragile and you can snap it by hand.
Really?
Yeah. It's interesting because as farmers, one of the things we try to do, at least, I mean, you got to remember we're growing living, breathing organisms yeah. in living, breathing waters. So there's a lot we can't control.
Yeah.
But we do aim to try to have a consistent harvest throughout the year.
Hell yeah. So we actually did an interview with a coffee farmer, last one.
Mm-hmm. Great interview, guys, by the way.
Thank you. He, Felipe mentioned how one possible adaptation to climate change in regards to farming is using biodiversity.
Yeah.
Do you guys see any way of using that in the future?
The first thing I want to say, again, kind of goes back to the keystone idea, mm-hmm. is that by way of us growing oysters are probably the best thing we could be putting in the water right now.
Yeah.
And then because of that, we're then helping to initiate biodiversity in our specific area, but I'm sure there is something more we could be doing.
I think with our company specifically, the only thing that we could really do possibly for biodiversity is to grow clams and possibly, if the state would let us, do scallops.
That's a good point.
Even know if that's legally allowed yet.
Okay.
But those are the other two things that would help draw out all of those contaminants and eat up all the algae that's starting to grow because of the warmer water temperatures.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
We are legally allowed to grow clams on our sites, but We're kind of floating this line between environmentalism and profitability, right? And there's nothing to say that those two things are mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
But usually when you talk to somebody, the general consensus is, well, you got to pick one. Well, that's not necessarily true.
Yeah. Getting less and less true every day.
Yeah, and I think we do a good job of proving that, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
But we're not ready as a company yet to start going into the clam market. That's a whole different set of gear. It's a different species of animal.
Okay.
So that would require us to figure out, yeah, I would love to do it from an environmentalism side, but if I can't afford to make payroll every week,
yeah,
I just can't.
Yeah. There's definitely gonna be some hurdles there. Like, it seems like you guys maybe already do the biodiversity thing by putting in already maybe one of the most important species that could be there.
Yeah.
Do you think pollution is affecting you guys more than climate change at the moment?
Yeah. So basically, the big picture climate change effect is going to be in the acidity of water, and over time the pH of the water becoming more acidic is detrimental to an oyster's ability to grow and maintain its shell. Short term, the bigger problems that we're seeing would be like in South Florida, for example, with all the red tide and algae blooms down there. We had actually considered, because my family is from Naples, I was trying to get an oyster lease down in Collier County, and quickly found out that they had out of the 365 days of 2016, only one day where they opened for harvest because of that's how bad the algal blooms were.
Oh,
that's awful.
And a lot of that is having to do with farming runoff.
Mm-hmm.
Down there, it's big sugar, but other places globally, it's other issues. But in that regard, you're talking more about water quality and changes in salinity. That's much easier to impact, and unfortunately, there are people that do affect that don't know they're doing it, or if they do, it doesn't matter to them. Tackling the problem of changing the actual acidity of the water is a much bigger, broader problem.
And the red tide problem isn't so much a problem with us losing product with it dying from the red tide, because the oysters can survive it and eat all the algae. It's a problem for the consumer, because once those oysters consume that algae, it creates a liver toxin, so that's why they close the water zone, because if somebody was to eat one of those, they would get massively sick.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. And I'm going to throw in a caveat here, because there have been a couple things that we've mentioned that are a little bit alarming in terms of like eating Gulf oysters, right? And to be honest, they should be. Yeah. They should be alarming. Gulf oysters don't have a great reputation. And we're doing everything we can to change that, because in all honesty, there are things we can do to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Florida Department of Agriculture, the FWC, they've done a great job of figuring out, okay, if we're going to allow the harvest and consumption of oysters from the Gulf of Mexico, what best practices need to be put in place so that people won't get sick and die? For example, during the summer months, you can't harvest oysters after 11 a.m. They have to be in the cooler by 11 a.m. If it's 11:01 and FWC is hanging out at the cooler and you've got oysters on your boat, you're either taking them back out or they're just going to dump them. And if you don't have every rule down to the T, we're dumping it. We're taking it.
What's the reasoning for the timing on that?
The timing on that it's less to do with the time and more to do with the temperature. Every oyster you've ever eaten, it doesn't matter where it comes from, what size it was, doesn't matter, has a specific bacteria in it. It's Vibrio for short. but every oyster has that bacteria in it.
Yeah.
But there's a certain temperature at which the reproduction of that bacteria hits an exponential point. And so if you allow that oyster to get too hot, it's going to be basically a petri dish of this bacteria.
Really?
Yeah. And if you don't have a good immune system, I mean, even if you do have a good immune system, you can still get very sick. But people with compromised Gross. Immune systems, that's sort of the perfect storm, right? As somebody who say is like maybe in their 80s and they've got a compromised immune system and they eat an oyster with a very high level of this Vibrio bacteria in it, it could kill them. So that's sort of their way of trying to mitigate that.
So you have oysters collected at noon, and you go and cater to like an old folks home.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to be like a lot of deaths.
Yeah, I'm not doing that. So even like today, for example, we got an order in for oysters that came at like 10, I think it was like 10:54 when I checked the time. And I was like, yeah, you're going to have to wait one more day because I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to bring in oysters after 11. Absolutely. It's not worth it to me from, financially, I don't care. You know, I don't care. You can wait a day for oysters. But from a moral standpoint, from a reputation standpoint, and just you do what's right because it's right.
Yeah. So that they want them ideally harvested earlier because it's a cooler temperature?
Mm-hmm.
I think I read a study that showed 2,000 to 3,000 colonies of bacteria per 1 gram of oyster, and an oyster is normally about 3 or 4 grams.
Mm.
And that was in a cool oyster. So if you take that 2,000 to 3,000 times 4 and then heat it up to 80, 90 degrees as it sits on the deck of the boat for a few hours, it shoots through the roof.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's why when you get older people, children, people with diabetes, any disorder, they can get very, very sick and put them in the hospital quickly.
Yeah. I feel like we're not doing a great job of selling the idea of eating oysters. Yeah. So, I want to say one of the things that our company specifically does, and we don't have to do this. This is just something that we choose to do.
Okay, that sounds cool.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of traceability built into our standards.
Yeah.
So while
that's awesome.
We meet best practices, we actually it's one of our goals to almost set the standard. And like, I don't want to be a pain in the ass to other ranchers, but I kind of hope that some of the things that we're doing actually become law. Because we go above and beyond in that regard. So we do things with tracking when and where and how our oysters are harvested so that, okay, I'm not, even though I could bring in oysters at 11 a.m., like, I want them in by 9.
You know, one of the steps that we take that I actually prefer everybody else would actually follow in our suit is you're allowed to show up at daybreak, start pulling oysters out of the water, keep them on the boat. They can stay out of the water the entire morning. And then you can bring them in at 10:59, and they're acceptable. We don't do that. We go and we pull them out, put them in the boat, bring them into the cooler. Yeah. They're out of the water for no more than 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the shade the entire time. So they never touch the baking sun like some people do for hours and hours every morning.
Yeah.
So do you guys think that when climate change comes through and ocean temperatures rise a little bit, do you think that time limit is going to change?
It has to. If anything, what I would prefer to see rather than the time slot change is them go to a temperature to temperature monitoring.
Yeah.
So that, and they had, that technology exists. I mean, there, we have a NOAA station, so you could actually pull up right now. They post it every 6 minutes, what the air temperature is, what the water temperature is. They have, five or six different things that they track, at least that they publish. I'm sure they probably track even more than that, but the technology exists for them to be able to actually track that data. I would like to see
that be the metric instead of time. Yeah.
And I would like to see that now, not when, you know, not when climate change gets worse. Like it's already bad.
Yeah.
You know? And there's not a lot we can do about it, but there are some things we can do about it. And at least from our side as farmers, that of course we would follow that. And I don't mean to brag and say that we're, you know, setting the standard, but we do aim to do that.
Yeah. It sounds like you guys kind of do.
Right. When and where we can, and we've gone out of our way at times, you know, at the cost of profit to do it. But I would like to see other farmers also kind of have their feet held to the fire.
Yeah.
To see that done.
That's wild. So not to say more stuff about how dangerous oysters could be, but
no, go for it, man.
With the waters getting warmer, that's just going to mean just a higher probability of oysters being more dangerous to consume.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But again, when best practices are put in place,
you can avoid that a little
exactly.
bit.
Exactly. Yeah. So it comes down to, it's everybody's responsibility, right? Yeah. It's like only you can prevent forest fires. only you can, I don't know, prevent shitty oyster practices. But we're certainly, as farmers,
you guys get that as a bumper sticker.
I will, and I'll get you one. So it comes down to us as farmers to make sure we're following best practices. And
yeah.
It's not a thing. This is not a comment that I make often. Mm-hmm. But the government does a great job of setting proper rules to make sure that that's done correctly.
Are you guys worried about your industry being like financially impacted?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, the biggest financial hardship that we have faced so far was Hurricane Michael. What a perfect storm of bad shit that all happened at the same time.
I don't mind it.
Yeah.
So basically, and this ties back to climate change, in that there are studies that show as the earth increases in temperature, big, huge, heavily impactful hurricanes are more prevalent.
Yeah.
So that's sort of my excuse to use that as a talking point. That was that point that we had 2 million. Not only do we have 2 million oysters in the water, 1.5 million of those, give or take, were market sized and ready to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So what our strategy was at that time was to, we were trying to capture the holiday market. And you have to, with farming, you have to plan in advance.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great quote out there, and I wish I had written it down so I could read it properly. There's a quote about farmers being the people who have the most faith, because all of your money basically gets buried in the dirt, and then you're just hoping that it grows, you know, and eventually you're able to sell it. So what we did, we had already had two unsuccessful harvests previously since 2014.
Michael.
Yeah. For various other reasons,
mm-hmm.
which you fail once, you learn from it, you correct it, and then you try again, okay?
And then a hurricane comes.
The try number two was a different thing, and then the fucking hurricane, right? So basically what had happened was, after our second unsuccessful harvest, we got all the things that we could control.
Mm-hmm.
We not only had we had it controlled, we had it actually controlled very well. What we were trying to do was, instead of having a consistent harvest throughout the year, as we said, market demand is highest during the winter months for various reasons, mostly because oysters are more of a celebration food, a luxury food. So the 3 weeks leading up to Hurricane Michael, we were beginning to sell thousands of oysters. Now, when I'm talking, we've got 2 million in the water. That's a small percentage, but everything was working.
Yeah.
Like everything that we had planned to do a year before was like, holy shit, guys, we're doing it. This is great. And that hurricane came and killed all of it. I remember I was in Boston on Sunday and got a text that there was a storm brewing in the Bahamas, and I was like, okay,
yeah,
whatever. And then Wednesday my livelihood was fucking gone. If what scientists say is true, which I tend to believe scientists, that increasing global temperatures are going to cause more frequent big hurricanes,
mm-hmm.
then yeah, that does terrify me, because it not only has it affected me in the past, it's still affecting me.
Yeah.
Like, we still have problems that we deal with because of that hurricane.
Really?
Yeah. Every day. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big thing about Gulf of Mexico storms is that, you know, they're relatively small coming off the coast of Africa. They make their way over, and then as soon as they hit the warmer waters of the Gulf, it's just like fuel for them.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about already warm waters getting even warmer. I mean, again, I know I'm not a scientist, but I'm also not an idiot.
Yeah, it sounds like hurricanes might be your bigger climate change fear, maybe.
Yeah, at the very least, it's the one that has specifically impacted us so far.
Yeah.
So anyway, eat our oysters.
Yeah. That's, I mean...
Throw us an underhand ball. How do the oysters taste?
I was literally... That's how I wanted to end it. Yeah, a lot of danger out there, a lot of hurricanes.
You know, that's a good insight for your, not just your listeners, but like the American public in general. People take for granted a lot what it takes to get food on their plates.
Oh yeah.
And I went to Florida State University. I majored in business, not knowing specifically what I wanted to do as a career. Mm. If you'd have told me, you know, 10 years ago, I was going to be an oyster farmer, I'd have believed you, but I'd have laughed. It would have been one of those things been like, I could see me doing something like that, but what a weird path that must have taken.
Sounds like me.
Right. But one of the things that I've learned that I hope, if there's any point that gets across, is that there's a lot of hard work and a lot of sacrifice that goes into feeding people. Mm-hmm. There've always been studies and estimates like this. So me saying this almost feels stupid, but there's a study out there that says that by the year 2050, the global population will exceed our ability to feed it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of work going into answering that problem and finding the solution to that. And we feel that we're a big part of that. You can gather, I think it's for every 1 gram of protein that you can get from an acre of land, you can get 30 grams from water. Not just directly, but indirectly. So again, going back to the fact that we grow the keystone species. So we could feed the population with oysters,
yeah.
But we can also help feed the population with fish. That is going to be the direction that that food needs to take in America.
Water?
And seafood, local seafood. There's a great book, American Catch by Paul Greenberg, that I suggest everybody read. I don't care how old you are, what industry you're in. Yeah. It's a great book because it has a lot to do with eating. I mean, yeah. You're talking about the bottom layer of the pyramid that I'm an idiot about again because I don't know.
Food?
No, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
So, oh, yeah.
Okay, Maslow's. Sorry, God. I'm
Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yeah, where the bottom is like food, and the top is like self-actualization.
Right. Yeah. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Thank you. So. We tend not to think much about those, like that bottom layer, because it's like, it's a given in our country. We're very blessed for that.
For sure. Yeah.
But just because it's there now doesn't mean it's going to be there in the future. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our attention as a country right now are on things that, it's not that they don't matter, but they are distracting in a lot of ways from things that not only do matter, but matter in a way that's really big and really important. Yeah. So, focusing on solutions to properly feed ourselves is something that we do every day.
Yeah.
And we encourage people to also participate in that conversation. And we're very active actually in like bringing people out on the boat, bringing people out on the water. You want to have an oyster right out of the water, we're more than happy to do it.
Sick.
That's
so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost kind of like we skipped, but like there's a potential there to skip that bottom layer when it comes to like a global concern.
Mm-hmm.
And in these countries where we have that privilege, you kind of go to the middle ones, mm-hmm. or maybe the top ones of like people who are working, or people who are like going for self-actualization, or like people who study all the time and don't like eat food like
right.
all day or something.
Yeah.
Right.
You can kind of take that bottom layer for granted when that in reality that's going to become a bigger and bigger issue as the population gets
larger. Totally. And even I was guilty of not thinking about it until working in that industry and seeing firsthand what those problems were.
Yeah.
So it's an easy thing to get caught up in.
That's so interesting, dude.
Yeah.
This is such a cool interview. Don't ever discount yourself for not knowing about science. Don't ever do that. This is so cool.
The reason I do that is I respect the sciences. I respect the amount of work that goes into being able to actually be like a peer-reviewed, like legitimate scientist, and I am not that. Like okay. The fact that my business degree is a Bachelor of Science, mm-hmm. I'm like, no, it's not. It fucking isn't.
Well, if nothing else, it's a little bit of like under promise, over deliver, you know?
There you go.
And that's cool.
There you go.
Do you guys, this one, we didn't write this down, but do you think there's going to be any effect with y'all with like sea level rise?
No.
Will that help or hurt in any way?
More space to grow oysters.
That's what I was thinking.
There he is, the optimist. Yeah, honestly, I don't think so. Here's a theory. Here's one off the top of my head.
Okay.
So in terms of natural oyster beds, it takes centuries, millennia for robust oyster bed ecosystems to grow. Imagine a sandbar with a bunch of oysters growing on it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a very long time for that to happen. And wild oysters don't grow everywhere because it takes very specific circumstances for an ecosystem to develop in which they can thrive. So I would say if sea levels do rise, what you're going to have is whatever remaining oyster beds there are globally now,
mm-hmm.
the sea level will rise to the point that they're no longer able to thrive, would be my guess.
And why is that?
Because oysters need to come in and out of the water as the tides increase and decrease.
Okay, so it'll make that fluctuation less possible.
Correct. I would imagine. I would imagine.
Yeah, just as like speculating.
Right. It's like at some point low tide.
Is it going to be low enough?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's not like an oyster. It's not like the oyster bars are going to just move to accommodate that. That's not how oyster bars work.
Yeah.
I'll run back to one of the comments I made before. Bree had asked, "Are we prepared? Are we preparing in any way for climate change?" And my answer to that was no. But there are things we're doing to not contribute to it. Yeah. So one of the things that we're doing that's that I think is really cool, and we get a lot of flack for it, which I don't give a shit, because we're sort of the hippies of the oyster industry.
Cool.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no which problem like there.
But well, you say that. one of the things we're doing is we're actually trying to create an oyster powered boat.
Nothing.
I'm sorry.
Nothing sucks.
God,
about that.
what a terrible.
I like that idea though.
That's not what I meant. That is not even close to what I meant.
Can you
sorry.
Explain?
A solar powered boat. Jesus. Okay. An oyster powered boat.
God.
Oh man, that was rough. A solar powered boat. So the biggest pollutant that we have that we contribute to directly is the fact that our boats are, you know, fossil fuel boats.
Yeah.
I think a standard four-stroke engine, the output of that in terms of greenhouse gases is something like, you know, it was like 4 or 40 times greater than a car.
Really?
Yeah. So like people talk about cars being energy inefficient. Mm. Boat motors are very inefficient.
The exhaust is piped right into the water.
And you know, now one of the things that we do, but you know, other farmers don't do it because they don't have to, and it's inconvenient to do.
Yeah.
Once we get to the lease, we shut the motor off, and we've set up a system in which we can pull ourselves via our cages, and we have kind of a rope and hook system that we just pull ourselves along, so we're not dumping that right. I mean, literally onto the product.
Yeah.
That's
smart.
Yeah. But again, you're not required to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things that we're conscientious about. But there's a grant that we're going to be going for. It's the ERICA grant. It's something like energy renewables and something. But it's a grant that the state has funded for renewable energy improvements in aquaculture specifically. And what we aim to do is actually create the state's, and by all accounts that we know of, the world's first 100% solar powered oyster boat, so that we are not only energy neutral, but we're setting a standard for which other farmers can also be energy neutral.
Hell yeah.
So we've got two boats. We just bought our second one today,
yeah.
But the other boat that we do have is a 24 foot Carolina skiff that we've outfitted with a top on it. That's perfectly flat.
Mm-hmm.
For solar panels, yeah. So we're gonna put a kilowatt of solar on it.
Yeah.
And basically, what we're doing right now are the calculations for the batteries for a battery backup system.
Yeah, that's hard work, man.
Yeah, it's not easy. That's for sure. We're very sunburnt, and our joints are very weak.
I have a listener question for me, the listener of you guys.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you guys ever find plastic out there?
Yeah.
All the time.
You know what was really kind of jarring after the hurricane was getting to see as much effort as we put into not polluting the water.
Yeah.
That hurricane, it was like it almost made it seem worthless.
Really?
There is so much shit in the water after that hurricane came through.
Gross.
From styrofoam, like entire, so a lot of the floating docks down there, which I would like to see a law put in place to prevent this, but a lot of the floating docks down there, they float because there's a layer of styrofoam beneath them.
Mm-hmm.
So like huge chunks of styrofoam. I don't even want to start listing the other things we find in there because the hurricane literally took entire houses and just dumped all the shit that was in it. And even the house itself.
Yeah.
There is so much shit in the water, by way of hurricanes coming through that it's sort of disheartening to think like I'm doing my part to make sure that my trash, like I almost think that it's more environmentally friendly to just throw your trash directly into the ocean than it is to throw it in the trash, to have it be shipped over to India, to then have it pushed back into the ocean. You know what I mean? I know it's a really shitty way of thinking about it. I know that's wrong. But to answer your question, we do find a lot of plastic in the water. It would take less time to tell you what we haven't found.
Mm.
Now, thankfully where we're at specifically, we as an oyster farming community have done a great job of cleaning up the waters. So we're finding less and less of it. As a problem, it's absolutely a problem, but I don't know what we can do about a damn hurricane coming through and doing that. You know what I mean?
Mm. I mean, it sounds like you guys are already doing your part by kind of spearheading like sustainability a little bit.
That's a good point. That's a good reminder is that even though we are doing our part and even though it's small and we're not big enough to solve the whole problem, doing your part is big enough.
Yeah, for and other people to see it at least.
Right. Even if you're just a consumer of oysters, ask where your oysters are from.
Yeah.
You know, there are traceability standards in place and companies like ours, we pay money at for no reason other than we just want to prove that we're doing things right.
Yeah.
We pay money every month to have neutral third parties come in and prove that we are not only maintaining best practices, but we're exceeding them. So it's not a big deal for you as a customer to walk into an oyster bar and ask, where are these from?
Mm-hmm.
And then keep asking. You know, I don't want to be that asshole that's like, you know, back in my waiter in the corner, like, oh, are these from Apalachicola? Oh, are they? But what about before that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's going to have to be a sense of responsibility on the consumer to understand where their food's coming from.
Yeah.
Because it matters.
Yeah.
It definitely matters. And the technology already exists to be able to answer those questions. Another sidebar conversation. Oysters are not the only luxury food product affected by climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, you just did an episode on coffee.
Yeah.
But I mean, beer, like,
oh,
that's a big one.
Really?
Yeah. I read a study recently that we need, it's like 142 million bales of barley a year to sustain global beer demand. And like with current like global climate patterns within like 5 to 10 years, that's just not going to be doable anymore. So like, it's not just oysters. It's it's beer, it's wine, it's seafood, it's coffee.
Yeah.
Like this is not just an oyster problem. This is a food problem.
Exactly.
And I don't know about you, but I kind of like my 3 meals a day.
I love my 3 meals a day. I'm very fortunate to have them.
Yeah.
I put down my PBR.
Oh my God.
My experience with oysters is I never had them growing up.
Yeah.
I never even saw an oyster before I was like 20.
Where are you from?
Tallahassee.
Same.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think last year got 3 oysters.
Okay.
First one, nothing on it.
Yep.
Ate it.
Probably terrible.
Totally grossed out.
Of course.
Just totally grossed out.
Of course.
So open to the idea though, I ate the second one.
Good for you.
Lemon juice.
Yeah.
And a little bit of Tabasco. Better. Third one, just lemon juice, the best.
Okay.
So I kind of warmed up into it.
Okay.
But what do you guys say is the ideal oyster conditions for eating?
Bro.
Yeah.
I'm a little
because I'm so open to it. I want to.
I'm biased.
Really?
Yeah.
To
my fucking oysters. Like
as you
I grow the best oyster you've
never
ever eaten.
Never trust a skinny chef.
And I right?
Yeah.
What the fuck are you trying to say? I say this because people tell me this all the time. We grow the best oysters.
Yeah.
The top of the water column is the place to grow them. They never touch the bottom. The two biggest complaints people get that I've heard anyway are that oysters are gritty and dirty. Mm. So there's like dirt in them.
Yeah.
And that they're slimy. Okay. Here's why you're never going to have either of those two things happen in our oyster. The dirt and grit, that comes from them being grown, you know, found in the mud. A wild oyster, it lives in the mud. And so as a bivalve, in order for it to feed, it has to open. Mm. And then it shuts and opens and shuts. So naturally, shit's going to get in that. Our oysters never get below 18 inches in the water column. So that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
The slime factor, that's a big one. And I hate that.
My favorite Nickelodeon TV show.
I like that.
Oh, God. I was actually... Okay, fun fact. I was actually on that show when I was like 7.
Wait, what show?
The Nickelodeon like slime show.
Slime no
time?
Way!
Yeah, Slime Time. I was on Slime Time when I was a kid.
What?
Yeah, we went to... My parents took me to Universal when I was a little kid. And, you know, it's like 7. I'm like barely even conscious.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was actually... I didn't get slimed.
Good.
But
good.
I played the cookie game. Anyway, so the other factor is the texture is weird. It's like people will like an oyster, so like, oh, it's like a booger. It's like snot.
Yeah.
A big part of that comes from... Here's the science I do know, all right?
Okay, sick.
It's my redemption time. Wild oysters most commonly have two chromosomes, and they're diploid oysters as such. Okay, the other wild oyster you'll find... Did I say diploids? Mm-hmm. Okay. Are tetraploids. Sorry. PBR. are tetraploids. They have four chromosomes. You have oysters with two chromosomes and oysters with four chromosomes.
Yeah.
Those oysters are able to reproduce. So what happens in the summer months, water hits 68 degrees Fahrenheit and oysters know it's time to spawn. Yeah. So they'll stop eating and they'll start reproducing. And all that means is males release their sperm and females release their eggs. During those times around oyster bars, the water looks like spit because it's just full of oyster reproductive junk. Another scientific term for you.
Yeah.
What we grow specifically is a triploid oyster. All that means is it doesn't reproduce. All it does is eat.
Oh, so it's the mule.
Okay.
Yes. Great. Cool. So we grow the mule of oysters.
That's interesting.
So during those summer months in which diploids and tetraploids are a little bit slimy, the reason that is such is because they're not eating, they're reproducing.
Yeah.
Whereas our oysters eat 12 months out of the year. So the consistency is very firm. So no grit, no sand, no mealiness, no sliminess.
Wow.
And again, we'll bring you guys out on the boat and you can say it for yourselves because it shouldn't mean anything for me.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
That sounds perfect.
And our salinity is good. Our salinity is, 20 parts per thousand on average.
Really?
For the astute oyster consumer. Anything below like 15 parts per thousand salinity is just going to taste like river water. And then personally, anything above like 25 parts per thousand salinity is going to be just way too salty.
I wonder, is salinity going to be affected by climate change at all?
The last time I heard anybody talk about it, it was because of the ice caps melting.
Mm-hmm.
It would add just an influx of fresh water into the system.
Okay.
Yeah, so that would be what you would see localized effects of it. Don't quote me on that one.
You say things and I'm like, I should know that.
I don't know, a big thing, just come down and see us so we can take you out on the boat.
Yeah.
Pretty much what I love to do.
Woo! There you go. Yeah, you bring the beers and we'll provide the oysters.
Easy.
25-8, 366.
25-8.
25 hours a day, 8 days a week, 366.
I see. Yeah. I thought you were putting some sort of weird way of having a phone number in there.
Oh, no.
No, I was like, I don't think that's... 7 digits.
No, we don't
cool.
We don't do a very good job of work-life balance,
you know, really
and that kind of comes with doing something that you love to do.
Yeah,
you know, and I didn't know I would fall in love with it like I did, but when you come out and see the environment we get to work in,
wow.
And now, you know, now just having the conversation, understanding the impact that you have, and sometimes you forget it when you do it every day.
Yeah,
you know, so you take it for granted, and it's conversations like these which help guys like Matt and I kind of remind ourselves that we're very fortunate and blessed to do what we do. And like, if you and Bree were to say that, like, oh, tomorrow would be a great opportunity for us to go out, I would drop everything to take you guys out there.
Wow.
Like, we're not a lot of people get to say that.
Yeah.
And I'm one of the reasons why we push through some of the difficult times that we push through is because we just love what we do.
Yeah. That's so cool. I love the sentiment of like that you didn't know that it was something that you were going to love to do.
Yeah. Bring lemons and crystal hot sauce also.
Crystal.
That's the basic. Yeah. If you're going to do, everybody wants to do hot sauce with oysters, a cayenne based hot sauce. Crystal. Okay. I'm not paid by them to say that. If you go to our Instagram,
you do want
to
pay us.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll continue to say it.
It's funny because if you go to our Instagram, like we've actually been really trying to get their attention.
Really,
and they've shared a couple posts that we've had, but like just genuinely speaking, Crystal is the best hot sauce. Go with oysters.
We'll tag him in this.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then just a good generic rule of thumb anyway. And this is more Matt's thing than it is mine, but champagne. I mean,
okay.
Champagne goes good with name a thing.
I mean, perfect. Champagne is the blue jeans of the wine world. Wow. With everything.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having us, man.
And I think that's about all she wrote.
I will see you now, or I'll see you on another time.
Wow, what a fun interview to listen to together. I'm still here talking to an audiophile of Brianna. Yeah, but if you enjoyed it, it would mean so much if you gave us like a 5-star on iTunes or showed it to a friend or, you know. But yeah, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram as No Planet Bcast. And yeah, have a good rest of your... lunch.
Yeah, it does. Thanks, guys.
Have a good rest of your lunch, and we will see you on the internet.
We might make a TikTok. I don't know.